Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Abolition Democracy, Beyond Empire, Prisons, and Torture by Angela Y. Davis, narrated by Angela Y. Davis.
Introduction by Eduardo Mendieta. Angela Y. Davis is known by many as the iconic face of 1970s Black Pride. Others know her as the former vice presidential candidate of the Communist Party of the United States, while others know her as a major feminist scholar who has written some of the most transformative and enduring texts of feminist thinking in the last quarter century. And a new generation of students, activists, and cultural workers got to know her in 1997, when Professor Davis helped found Critical Resistance, a national organization dedicated to dismantling the prison industrial complex, a topic that is central to her current scholarship and activism. In fact, throughout each of her life's projects, Angela Y. Davis has been an unwavering prison activist whose focus has returned repeatedly to the opposition of prisons, imprisonment, and racialized punishment. Vladimir I. Lenin claimed that prisons are the universities of revolutionaries, and while Angela Davis was already a revolutionary by the time she was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list on false charges, driven underground, arrested, and incarcerated, her work has been indelibly marked by her experience of imprisonment. Some of her earliest published works were written during her 16-month incarceration, brilliant pieces in which she established the links between surplus repression, punishment, and the racial violence at the heart of white supremacy in the United States. Reading Davis, one is immediately struck by her sources, starting with her own experience as a Black woman, political prisoner, and American citizen who was at one time labeled an enemy of the state, only to then become the focus of an intense international solidarity movement, the Free Angela Davis campaign, that led to her acquittal in 1972. Another source is her continuous engagement with the canonical figures in what one can call a tradition of Black critical political philosophy that has found two towering figures in Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois. This engagement harkens back to her early 70s lectures on liberation, in which we find a neo-Marxist or Frankfurt School approach to the thought of Douglass. In one of the essays that Davis wrote while she was in the Marin County Jail, Davis turns to Du Bois, for it is in him that she found the most severe and explicit critique of the prison system in the United States. It is in Du Bois, furthermore, that Davis discerns the historical links between slavery, the failed Reconstruction, the turn-of-the-century lynchings, the emergence of the KKK, Jim Crow, the riots of the post-Civil War period, and the rise of the racial ghettos in all major U.S. cities. It is important to underscore Davis's engagement with Douglass's and Du Bois' work, for both stand in for two philosophical approaches in Davis's thinking, approaches that must be juxtaposed against one another. On the one hand, Douglass represents an existential concern with freedom that easily translates into a deference to political liberty in terms of voting rights. Indeed, in a 1995 essay entitled From the Prison of Slavery to the Slavery of Prison, Frederick Douglass and the Convict Lease System, Davis presents a devastating critique of Douglass's myopia and inability to both speak out and mobilize around what was obviously a betrayal of the political freedom won by Blacks. Shortly after the Civil War, the South underwent a process of democratization that was awe-inspiring and utopian, although tragically short-lived. Union troops were stationed in the South to make sure that Blacks would be protected while going to the voting polls. Blacks were elected as senators. Schools were opened. A vibrant Black public sphere began to emerge. This short-lived period came to be known as the Reconstruction. Within a decade, however, the Reconstruction had been halted, and a process of retreat back towards slavery began. White legislators mandated a series of laws that forced Black freed men to become indentured servants by criminalizing them. The prerogatives of former white slave owners were legislated and legalized in the infamous Black Laws. Once in prison, convicts were leased or rented for absurd fees to the private entrepreneurs of the New South. This process became known as the convict leasing system, and historians have gone so far as to say that it was worse than slavery. The black laws of the South turned black free men into criminals, so that their labor could be exploited even more pugnaciously and rapaciously than when they had been slaves. The convict leasing system became one of the most lucrative mechanisms for simultaneous control, along with gerrymandering of black free labor and extreme exploitation. Du Bois put it this way: "This penitentiary system, the prison leasing system, began to characterize the whole South." In Georgia, at the outbreak of the Civil War, there were about 200 white felons confined at Milledgeville. There were no Negro convicts, since under the discipline of slavery, Negroes were punished in the plantation. The white convicts were released to fight in the Confederate armies. The whole criminal system came to be used as a method of keeping Negroes at work and intimidating them. Consequently, there began to be a demand for jails and penitentiaries beyond the natural demand due to the rise of crime. According to historians, precious little is known of Douglass's views on the convict leasing system. Davis critiques Douglass's loud silence on this matter because it was surely a nightmare that most blacks in post-Civil War America lived and experienced firsthand. Douglass, in Davis's view, may have been blinded to this reality because he was so thoroughly focused on getting the ballot for blacks that in the process he entirely neglected the economic well-being of blacks. For Davis, convict leasing was a totalitarian effort to control black labor in the post-emancipation era, and it served fully as a symbolic reminder to black people that slavery had not been fully disestablished. Davis also faults Douglass for his overconfidence in the law as an allegedly dispassionate and impartial tool that could not be used to roll back the gains of the post-emancipation period. As an Enlightenment thinker, Douglass saw law as a mechanism to bring about justice and democracy for black Americans, but failed to see how it could be used and was used to brand black human beings as criminals. In contrast, Davis turns to Du Bois as the exemplar political thinker, even as Davis also acknowledges the pioneering work of D.E. Tobias and Mary Church Terrell, two other black scholars who studied and documented the devastating effects of the prison leasing system. In Du Bois, Davis finds a critique of Douglass's naive trust in both the economic and political independence of post-slavery blacks, as well as a critique of the ways in which the state was a direct party to preservation and mutation of slavery. Du Bois saw clearly how the state participates in the criminalization of blacks so that their labor could be extracted through the mechanism of the prison leasing system. As Du Bois put it in his monumental Black Reconstruction, "In no part of the modern world has there been so open and conscious a traffic in crime for deliberate social degradation and private profit as in the South since slavery. The Negro is not antisocial. He is no natural criminal. Crime of the vicious type outside endeavor to achieve freedom or in revenge for cruelty was rare in the slave South. Since 1876, Negroes have been arrested on the slightest provocation and given long sentences or fines that they were compelled to work for, as if they were slaves or indentured servants again. The resulting peonage of criminals extended into every southern state and led to the most revolting situations." For Du Bois, black labor was neither economically free nor politically self-determining. Thus, blacks entered a racialized public sphere of American democracy as disadvantaged and unequal. Democracy for blacks had been withheld at the very moment it had been promised, upon the abolition of slavery. With the abolition of slavery, blacks ceased to be slaves, but immediately became criminals. And as criminals, they became slaves of the state. Thus, Du Bois represents for Davis an anti-capitalist, anti-statist, anti-law perspective that is profoundly attentive to what we can call the social imaginary or civic imagination. Davis, however, is neither an exegete nor historian. She is an original radical thinker whose contributions to an emerging theory of penalty are used in the classroom as much as they are by activists and community organizers. In the context of this short introduction, we only have space to give the general shape and main lines of argument in Davis's thinking, which I think can be discussed in terms of the following themes: disenfranchisement, For Davis, one of the functions of the prison industrial complex is to withhold the vote from people of color. All 50 U.S. states bar former inmates from acquiring state licenses. This means that they are de facto excluded from many, if not most, jobs. A total of 7 states permanently disenfranchise formerly incarcerated persons. 7 additional states also disenfranchise certain types of former incarcerated persons, which is determined according to the type of crime they allegedly committed. 33 states disenfranchise persons on parole, and 48 states disenfranchise persons in prisons, the sole exceptions being Maine and Vermont. Capital extraction. Davis often delves into how the prison is a mechanism of wealth extraction from African Americans, not just through exploitation of prison labor, but also by appropriating black social wealth. By social wealth, Davis means the wherewithal of black Americans to sustain their communities, schools, churches, home ownership, etc. At any given moment, given the exorbitant amount of blacks in prisons, social wealth does not return to black communities, or it is withdrawn through political and economic disenfranchisement and exclusion. Social branding. Once a black American has been in prison, he or she is permanently branded. As recent studies have shown, it is more difficult for former black prisoners to regain entry into society than it is for their white counterparts. Racial contract. In Davis's thinking, the racial contract refers to the social, political, cultural, and economic reality in which it is more advantageous to be white than a person of color, because all norms are de facto whiteness norms. Within the racial contract, social punishment is accepted because it is done primarily to blacks. So we tolerate a highly punitive society because its punishment is performed on them and not on us. For Davis, the prison industrial complex also contributes to the domination of racial minorities by domesticating the civic imagination of white Americans. Ritual violence. In Davis's work, she discusses how ritual violence cleanses and expiates the social order. The prison system naturalizes the violence that is enacted against racial minorities by institutionalizing a viciously circular logic. Blacks are in prison because they are criminals because they are black, and if they are in prison, they deserved what they got. Prison, in more than one way, institutionalized the lynchings of the turn of the 20th century, when Jim Crow was at its cruelest and most violent. Sexual coercion. Davis repeatedly returns to the fact that the prison uses sexualized abuse for social control. The aggressive masculinity of the inmates is matched by the sexual coercion enacted by the guards and wardens in prisons. In this way, the prison system is a regime that is predicated on sexual violence, that is, at the same time, highly racialized. Surplus repression. Davis critiques how the institutionalization of the prison regime into an industry instills in the minds of citizens that prisons are both inevitable and desirable. They are a logical and evident way to deal with crime. We have so many prisons because we build them, and so many sectors of society are invested in their perpetuation. Citizens, however, are not allowed to ask, is imprisonment the only way to deal with crime and social dysfunction? Is crime really dealt with by prisons? Are the long-term costs of imprisonment worth the momentary benefits of putatively deterring crime? Interconnected systems. In her work on prisons, Davis often focuses on the insidious relationship between the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex. Acknowledging these relationships is a necessary first step in developing strategies to oppose and abolish the institutions and their underlying causes. For authentic democracy to emerge, Davis argues abolition democracy must be enacted. The abolition of institutions that advance the dominance of any one group over any other. Abolition democracy, then, is the democracy that is to come, the democracy that is possible if we continue with the great abolition movements in American history, those that opposed slavery, lynching, and segregation. So long as the prison industrial complex remains, American democracy will continue to be a false one. Such a false democracy reduces people and their communities to the barest biological subsistence because it pushes them outside the law and the polity. Is this not what we plainly saw in New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina? Such a bare existence is one that can be ignored and neglected or extinguished with impunity precisely because it is the law that renders it expendable. Punishment has been deployed against the human body as though it were a black body. The death penalty survives not as the ultimate punishment, but because it was primarily a form of punishment against the black flesh and black freedom. And this is what is so indelibly announced in the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. As neo-abolitionist Joy James put it, the 13th Amendment ensnares as it emancipates. In fact, it functions as an enslaving anti-enslavement narrative. The interviews in this book were all conducted by me alone, except the final one, to which Chad Kautzer, a graduate student at Stony Brook University and a peace activist, contributed. In these discussions, which took place over the span of 8 months, during which we were witness to the disclosures of torture at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, Angela Davis takes her analysis of the prison industrial complex to new levels. She focuses on the effects of the prison regime on our foreign relations and discusses how our society seems unable to acknowledge the humanity and suffering of others, as manifested today in the people shown in the Abu Ghraib photos. The images seem to affirm for us the fiction of American democracy at the very moment that this democracy is at its weakest and most betrayed. In analyses that are both original and poignant, Davis lays bare the links between empire, prison, and torture, analyses that will outlast our current historical moment. These interviews are immediate responses from a former enemy of the state who has become of the most important political intellectuals to perhaps the most intense crisis of American political and ethical identity of our time.
Politics and prisons. Eduardo Mendieta asked, in 1974, your book, Angela Davis, An Autobiography, was published by Random House. Since then, it has become a classic of African-American letters that is central to the traditions of Black women writers and Black political thinkers. In many ways, your autobiography also harkens back to the tradition of Black slave narratives. How do you see this work now with 30 years hindsight? Well, thanks for reminding me that this is the 30th anniversary of the publication of my autobiography. At the time I wrote the book, I did not see myself as a conventional autobiographical subject, and thus did not locate my writing within any of the traditions you evoke. As a matter of fact, I was initially reluctant to write an autobiography. First of all, I was too young. Second, I did not think that my own individual accomplishments merited autobiographical treatment. Third, I was certainly aware that the celebrity or notoriety I had achieved had very little to do with me as an individual. It was based on the mobilization of the state and its efforts to capture me, including the fact that I was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. But also, and perhaps most importantly, I knew that my potential as an autobiographical subject was created by the massive global movement that successfully achieved my freedom. So the question was how to write an autobiography that would be attentive to this community of collective struggle. I decided then that I did not want to write a conventional autobiography in which the heroic subject offers lessons to readers. I decided that I would write a political autobiography exploring the way in which I had been shaped by movements and campaigns in communities of struggle. In this sense, you can certainly say that I wrote myself into the tradition of Black slave narratives. Mendieta, in what way do you think that the Black political biography plays a role within this tradition of American letters? Well, of course, the canon of American letters has been contested previously, and if one considers the autobiography of Malcolm X as an example, which, along with literature by such writers as Zora Neale Hurston, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, that has clearly made its way into the canon, one can ask whether the inclusion of oppositional writing has really made a difference. Has the canon itself been substantively transformed? It seems to me that struggles to contest bodies of literature are similar to the struggles for social change and social transformation. What we manage to do each time we win a victory is not so much to secure change once and for all, but rather to create new terrains for struggle. Mendieta. Since we are talking about canons, it seems to me that your work fits within another tradition, the philosophical canon. If we think of the work of Berthier, of Jean-Paul Sartre, Martin Luther King, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Antonio Gramsci, Primo Levi, these are philosophical figures who have reflected upon their prison experiences. Do you see your work contributing to this philosophical tradition of prison writing? And if so, how? Well, oftentimes prison writing is described as that which is produced in prison or by prisoners, and certainly Gramsci's prison notebooks provide the most interesting example. It is significant that Gramsci's prison letters have not received the consideration they deserve. It would be interesting to read Gramsci's letters alongside those of George Jackson. These are two examples of prison intellectuals who devoted some of their energies to the process of engaging critically with the implications of imprisonment at a more concrete philosophical level. Personally, I found it rather difficult to think critically about the prison while I was a prisoner. So I suppose I follow in the tradition of some of the thinkers you mentioned. However, I did publish a piece while I was in jail that could be considered a more indirect examination of issues related to imprisonment. I wrote an article entitled Reflections on the Black Woman's Role in the Community of Slaves, which helped me formulate some of the questions that I would later take up in my efforts to theorize the relationship between the institution of the prison and that of slavery. I produced another piece, a paper I wrote for the Conference for the Society for the Study of Dialectical Materialism, associated with the American Philosophical Association, entitled Women and Capitalism, Dialectics of Oppression and Liberation. Both pieces were published in the Angela Y. Davis Reader in 1998. If They Come in the Morning, the book on political prisoners I wrote and edited with Bettina Aptaker, is another example of my prison writing. Finally, I also wrote an extended study of fascism, which was never published. But it was only after I was released that I felt I had sufficient critical distance to think more deeply about the institution of the prison drawing from and extending the work of the prison intellectual George Jackson. Mendieta, you were trained as a philosopher, yet you teach in a program called the History of Consciousness at the University of California. Do you think that philosophy can play a role in political culture in the United States? And has philosophy influenced your work on aesthetics, jazz, and in particular, the way in which you analyze the situation of Black women? Absolutely. And I think that I draw from my background in philosophy in that I try to ask questions about contemporary and historical realities that tend to be otherwise foreclosed. Philosophy provides a vantage point from which to ask questions that cannot be posed within social scientific discourse that presumes to furnish overarching frameworks for understanding of our social world. I have learned a great deal from Herbert Marcuse about the relationship between philosophy and ideology critique. I draw particular inspiration from his work, Counter-Revolution and Revolt, that attempts to directly theorize political developments of the late 1960s. But at the same time, the framework is philosophical. How do we imagine a better world and raise the questions that permit us to see beyond the given? Mendieta, there are beautiful pages in your autobiography about your relationship with Herbert Marcuse, who was your teacher and mentor and part of the Frankfurt School. You spent some years in Frankfurt in the late 1960s. You also studied with Theodore Adorno, Jürgen Habermas, and Max Horkheimer. Do you see yourself as a critical theorist in this Frankfurt School sense? Well, I've certainly been inspired by critical theory, which privileges the role of philosophical reflection while simultaneously recognizing that philosophy cannot always by itself generate the answers to the questions it poses. When philosophical inquiry enters into conversation with other disciplines and methods, we are able to produce much more fruitful results. Marcuse crossed the disciplinary borders that separate philosophy, sociology, and literature. Adorno brought music and philosophy into the conversation. These were some of the first serious efforts to legitimate interdisciplinary inquiry. Mendieta, you ran twice as the vice presidential candidate of the Communist Party in the United States before leaving the party in the 1990s. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the demise of the Soviet Union, what role, if any, can communism play today? Although I am no longer a member of the Communist Party, I still consider myself a communist. If I did not believe in the possibility of eventually defeating capitalism and in a socialist future, I would have no inspiration to continue with my political work. As triumphant as capitalism is assumed to be in the aftermath of the collapse of the socialist community of nations, it also continually reveals its inability to grow and develop without expanding and deepening human exploitation. There must be an alternative to capitalism. Today, the tendency to assume that the only version of democracy available to us is capitalist democracy poses a challenge. We must be able to disentangle our notions of capitalism and democracy so as to pursue truly egalitarian models of democracy. Communism or socialism can still help us to generate new versions of democracy. Mendieta, do you think that the anti-globalization movement, the anti-WTO movement...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?